up here in Alaska, looking around for gold. Like a crazy fool, I'm a-digging in this frozen grounds of cold. But with each new day, I pray I'll strike it rich, and then I'll go back home and claim my love in Saginaw, Michigan. I wrote my love,
I wrote my love
in Saginaw, Michigan. I said, honey, I'm a-coming home, please wait for me. And you can tell your dad I'm coming back a richer man. I hit the biggest rack in Klondike history.
Her dad met me
in Saginaw, Michigan.
Saginaw, Michigan.
He gave me a great big party with champagne. Then he said, son, you're a wise, young, ambitious man. Will you sell your father-in-law your Klondike claim? Now he's up there in Alaska, digging in the cold, cold ground. The greedy fool is looking for the gold I never found. It serves him right, and no one here is missing him, least of all the newlyweds of Saginaw, Michigan, with the happiest man and wife in Saginaw, Michigan. He's ashamed to show his face in Saginaw, Michigan.
Well, I never felt more like singing a blues, 'cause I never thought that I'd ever lose your love. Why'd you do me this way? Well, I never felt more like crying all night, 'cause everything's wrong and nothing ain't right without you. You got me singing the blues. The moon and stars no longer shine. The dream is gone I thought was mine. There's nothing left for me to do but cry over you. Well, I never felt more like running away, but why should I go? 'Cause I couldn't stay without you. You got me singing the blues. Singing the blues, 'cause I never thought that I'd ever lose your love, dear. Why'd you do me this way? Well, I never felt more like crying all night, 'cause everything's wrong and nothing ain't right without you. You got me singing the blues. The moon and stars no longer shine. The dream is gone I thought was mine. There's nothing left for me to do but cry over you. Well, I never felt more like running away, but why should I go? 'Cause I couldn't stay without you. You got me singing the blues.
Well, here I sit a high, getting ideas. Ain't nothing but a fool to live like this. Out all night, running wild. Woman sitting home with a month-old child. Dang me, dang me. They ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me? Boop, boop. One more. Boop, 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 boop. just sitting around drinking with the rest of the guys. Six rounds bought and I bought five. Spent the groceries and half the rent, like $14.27. So dang me, they ought to take a rope and hang me high from the highest tree. Woman, would you weep for me? One more. They say roses are red and violets are purple.
The Biden Department of Justice is making a risky political move in arguing and appealing the Florida judge's decision about masks on planes. And if this fails to work, this could jeopardize the ability of the CDC and other agencies to ever require masking or other public health guidelines on public transportation if it fails. So it is very politically risky. So let's back up and I'll tell you what's going on. Earlier this week, a Florida judge decided that the CDC had overstepped its authority with the masks on planes. And generally, we call it masks on planes, but it's like masks on mass transit regulated by the federal government. But let's call it masks on planes. The argument was CDC overstepped its boundaries. And the argument made by the judge in her decision was that the CDC is allowed to put in place guidelines for the sanitation of airplanes, and that a mask on a person is not really about sanitation on airplanes. Now, you could argue, well, you prevent needing to sanitize the seats if people wear masks and they don't put germs on the seats. Like, it starts to become a semantic thing. But one of the notable aspects about the decision was that argument could have been made at any time during the pandemic, and it was made by a judge now, with just like 10 days left until most likely the masks would be coming off anyway, although we're not totally sure. Earlier yesterday, Joe Biden was asked, should people still be wearing masks on planes? And the Republican Party and others made a big deal out of this answer, which Joe Biden gave.
Should people continue to wear masks on planes?
That's up to them.
That's up to them, saying that is a personal decision. It's an individual decision. It's not for the government to tell people what to do. And then moments later, the Department of Justice has appealed the federal ruling on the transportation mask mandate. CNN and others reporting the Justice Department Wednesday appealed a ruling by a federal judge that struck down the mask mandate for mass transportation following a recommendation by the CDC. It is the CDC's continuing assessment that at this time, an order requiring masking in indoor transportation remains necessary for public health. They will monitor. They will appeal. There is a court decision that is ultimately coming forward. So let's talk through the different aspects of this. Some are focusing on the Biden administration. The left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. Joe said it's a personal decision, and yet his DOJ is appealing. I actually don't think that's a problem in any way. We've said before, when it was Trump trying to direct the DOJ on what to do, we would say Trump should have no involvement with what the DOJ does, who it investigates, what it does. It should be just up to the DOJ. So it's a good thing that Joe Biden gave us his opinion. Well, right now it's an individual decision because at the time it was. And separately, as is supposed to happen at the end of the day, the CDC, in consultation with the DOJ, have said we still want this and we believe that legally we have a case. So the DOJ is appealing. I don't have any issue with that. And Republicans have been saying, oh, it's chaos. Joe says one thing. No, this is happening as it should. Joe Biden gave his opinion. The DOJ is making its decision in consultation with the CDC, and they will carry forward a legal argument as to why the masks should remain, which is their opinion. Now, what is the risk to the DOJ doing this, particularly when the mask mandate may have been ending on May 3rd anyway? We don't know that for sure. Originally, the mask mandate was through April 18th. There was an extension through May 3rd. Cases are actually rising now, 25-30%. It's not clear whether medically it makes sense to get rid of masks on planes, but it seemed politically it was likely coming to an end on May 3rd anyway. What's the risk to doing this? Well, the risk is, imagine that the DOJ fights this as full-throatedly as they can, and they don't get the masks put back on. That could then serve as really powerful and destructive precedent in the future. Imagine we get the next wave, you know, call it the whatever wave, the Sigma wave. And it's more contagious than ever. It's more deadly than ever. And it would be appropriate to say masks have to be on at airports and on planes. If this decision doesn't go the DOJ's way, there may be a total inability to put in place a mask mandate when it's like really needed. Right now, it's like probably a good idea. But listen, maybe we leave it up to people to decide. We could have a situation in 6 months and 12 months where it's like, wow, we absolutely need masks on planes. And there might be no way to get it done because of the decision that might be forthcoming here. So that's the legal and political risk. It also would just look bad if, you know, hero Trump appointed 35-year-old female judge prevails over Garland and the DOJ. It just looks bad politically. And so that is the risk. And we won't know for a little bit what happens, but that is what's going on. Major breaking news from within the world of the Democratic Party. Senator Bernie Sanders, according to aides, has not ruled out running for president again in 2024 if Joe Biden doesn't run. There is a very interesting article in The Washington Post. Senator Bernie Sanders is open to running for president in 2024 if Biden declines to seek re-election, according to a campaign memo, a top political advisor distributed to allies on Wednesday and shared with The Washington Post. Quote, in the event of an open 2024 Democratic primary, Senator Sanders has not ruled out another run for president. So we advise that you answer any questions about 2024 with that in mind. This is a memo from Faz Shakir, close Sanders advisor who managed his campaign in 2020. The memo was shared by a person with direct knowledge of its contents on the condition of anonymity because it was not released publicly and confirmed by a second person with direct knowledge of the contents. So many in my audience have been clamoring, saying 2024 will finally be the time for Bernie. Everybody will realize that it was a mistake in 2016 for him not to be the nominee. And it was a mistake in 2020 for him to not be the nominee, and or it was stolen from him. And 24 is when Bernie will sail to the nomination and then sail to the presidency. I think that this is a really bad idea. I know many in my audience will be furious with me. I like Bernie. I supported Bernie in 2016. I supported Bernie in 2020. Yes, I acknowledged when Bernie no longer had a shot in those campaigns and said, well, I'm going to vote for the best alternative of those who are left. But I'm a Bernie supporter from 2016 and 2020. I don't think Bernie should talk about running in 2024. I don't even think Bernie should be considering running in 2024. And I'm ready for the hate. At this point, Bernie Sanders has become a perennial candidate in the sense of the guy who always runs and never wins. It doesn't mean he never could have won or should have won or that he wouldn't have been a great president. I think he would have. Bernie will be 83 years old in 2024. His term would start in 2025. He would be, I don't remember what month he was born in, but he would be 87 or 88 at the time that this Bernie Sanders term would end. This just doesn't seem, if you zoom out, big picture, 30,000 foot view, like the direction that the Democratic Party should go to say, okay, we've had what we've had in the last 8 years. We have all the history that we've had. Let's make our nominee, after all of the criticisms of wanting and needing someone younger than Biden, let's go with the 83-year-old who lost twice. It just doesn't seem like the way to go. And I'm willing to hear other arguments and I'm ready for people to cancel me over this. But it doesn't seem like the best thing for the party. I don't really care about the party. It also doesn't seem like the best thing for the progressive movement, which I do care about. Now, who's better than Bernie? That's a separate segment. We're not even through the midterms. That's a different conversation. But it's time for a new generation to lead, not someone even older than Biden who's lost twice and I hate to say it, this is a tough pill for me to swallow, but who's not nearly as popular as looking at Twitter and Reddit makes it seem. That's the reality. I think it's been enough. And quite frankly, I worry that it could even start to border on embarrassing and kind of a joke if Bernie runs again. I think that there will be a lot of very unserious, this is a joke type reactions if Bernie runs again in 2024. I don't question the genuine desire of Bernie to do what he wants to do and that he cares about the thing. I share it. I'm aligned with him. I'm highly aligned. I'm not speaking as an ideologue here. I'm speaking as a strategist and thinking about what makes the most sense from that perspective in 2024. With respect, this is my view. I don't hate anybody. I'm not attacking anybody. I just think this is not the right way to go. So my thought would be, don't run in 2024, Bernie. I am ready. I am so ready to hear your thoughts. Find me on Twitter at @dpacman. Tell me whether you agree or disagree. Any responses to this that are toxic ad hominems, some will be anti-Semitic, even though it's crazy. I'm Jewish and Bernie's Jewish, but this is the type of commentary that leads to anti-Semitic replies from some in my audience. It's all going to go where it belongs, straight into the trash. But substantive replies, I'm ready for. Find me on Twitter at @dpacman. I invite you to join the discussion on the David Pakman Show subreddit. You can find it at davidpakman.com/reddit. That's R-E-D-D-I-T. We now have about 35,000 of our viewers and listeners participating in discussions there. A few notable posts I spotted this morning. One was, hey, is anyone else receiving Mehmet Oz text scams? And they actually posted a screenshot of a text scam they received that said, this Dr. Oz report will change your life. Yeah, I have to tell you, I get stuff like this also. I get a lot of it via WhatsApp, interestingly enough. But we have no evidence that this is actually associated in any way with Dr. Oz nor his campaign. A lot of these things are just kind of like preying on the notoriety and name recognition of people like Dr. Oz. And I think, you know, report it, block it, whatever. But it's not clear to me that Dr. Oz is actually sending out text messages trying to scam people and sell them bogus medical reports. He does his bogus medical reporting on his own show, which, by the way, is it even going on now that he's running for Senate? I really couldn't tell you. But there's all sorts of text scams. I actually got a recent one. Let me see if I can pull this up. This is an interesting one. There's this guy in the crypto world called Mike Novogratz. He's a gold trader or something. Anyway, I got a text scam about that one where they wanted me to give someone money to mirror the trades of Mike Novogratz. You know, I just reported and block it right away. I just pulled it up in my trash. That doesn't mean that these things are actually associated with the people. I'm sure that has nothing to do with Mike Novogratz. So be on the lookout for all sorts of different scams. But there's many things we can slam Dr. Oz for. I am not aware right now that he is actually doing this text scamming. Another post reminded our Reddit users of a seminal event in David Pakman Show history. This post says, remember that time David turned out to be a gay teen with AIDS? I hope I'm not the only one who remembers. Now, this is not a fun. AIDS and teen gay bullying, none of it is funny. But what was funny, and the viewer has it slightly wrong, about a decade ago, I appeared in a film about something really sad, which is gay teens who are bullied so relentlessly that they take their own lives. And it's horrible. That's a real thing. And that happens. That didn't happen to me. And I was still featured in a documentary with like an in memoriam thing where I was sort of like eulogized in a way as a gay teen who was bullied and took my own life. And I wasn't a teen at the time. The picture they used was of me at like age 27. I guess I was youthful at the time. I was not a teen. I was not gay. I was not bullied, and I, at the time, was very much alive. So that is an incredible moment in David Pakman Show history. Not a funny topic, but sort of kind of curious that I was included in that. And yeah. Okay, thanks for reminding us. And then lastly, Michael Cohen mentions David in his latest podcast. Yeah, this is cool. Many people may or may not know this. Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, who now is playing a really prominent role in a number of different investigations into Trump and has a very successful podcast and on and on. He watches the David Pakman Show. He's in our audience. It's great. And we'll exchange messages sometime. I was on his show. He was on my show. He sometimes will make some of the jokes we make on this show that make it clear he pays attention. He was interviewing Kurt Eichenwald, and he brought me up. Listen to this.
Hey, if Trump is president, but Biden is president, the guy's like, yes.
I think that's David Pakman, who was actually doing a video like that. I saw something like that too. It was with a husband and a wife, and he just started fumbling around. You know,
yeah, I mean, could not figure out. None of it makes any sense. And
how can it make sense? You can't. You know, it's
okay. Anyway, so that was my cameo by name drop on Michael Cohen's podcast. It's a great podcast. Mea culpa. I do recommend people check it out. Join the discussion at davidpakman.com/Reddit. All right, let's get into the one story that has been most requested over the last 24 hours. Donald Trump was interviewed by Piers Morgan. Trump is soaking wet. I mean, just dripping with sweat. Looks like a rotisserie chicken. He almost looks like he's been seasoned with paprika and put under a broiler. In a promo released by the Piers Morgan show, it looks like Trump explodes, ends the interview abruptly, and walks out. Let's take a look at this. This is a 30-second preview of a forthcoming interview with the failed former president.
Okay, Piers, I'm ready.
A former president in denial.
I'll be completely straight with you to your face.
I think I'm a very honest man. Much more honest than you, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
It was a free and fair match. You lost.
Only a fool would think
you think I'm a fool?
I do now, yeah.
With respect.
Excuse me.
Okay, with respect, the legislature produced the hard evidence.
Excuse me.
The most explosive interview of the year.
I don't think you're real.
It's, I realize just, I'm not like...
Very dishonest. Let's finish up the interview.
Morgan versus
Turn
Trump.
Turn the camera off.
Very dishonest.
So certainly from that, this looks like the interview of the year. I mean, it's hard to imagine anything more explosive and comical. Trump dripping with sweat, disheveled, telling Piers that he's dishonest, and Piers telling him this, that. It looks absolutely crazy. It looks fascinating. The problem is that there is now the claim being made, and we're still trying to figure out the truth of it, that that promo is so deceptively edited that the true nature of the interview is completely different, that it was, there were contentious moments, but it didn't end on that note, that the interview went over by like 40 minutes from the 20 minutes it was supposed to be, and that mostly they got along. So NBC now has put out an article which says Trump releases audio that appears to refute the claim that he walked out of the interview over 2020 questions. An audio recording obtained by NBC News appears to show that Trump's highly publicized interview with Piers Morgan didn't end with Trump storming off the set, as edited promotional video clips suggest. Instead, according to the recording, which was provided by Trump's spokesman, the two men thanked each other and laughed at the conclusion of the interview for Talk TV, a subsidiary of Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. Talk TV is set to debut Monday. It teased the interview, billed as the most explosive interview of the year. In a video summary dramatized with cinematic music, it portrays Trump as being angry about the content of the questions. Turn the camera off. Very dishonest. But the audio at the end of the interview appears to tell a different story. The two men laughed and thanked each other, the recording shows. There are no signs of Trump storming off set. That was a great interview, Morgan says. Trump agrees. Yeah. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it, Morgan says. Trump then turns and says, turn the camera off. But by then, Trump was already up from his chair. So what is the truth here? I genuinely don't know. I genuinely don't know. I'm interested in the interview regardless. To be perfectly frank, my opinion of Piers Morgan is barely higher than that of Trump's. I think either is capable of extraordinary dishonesty. And the interview, as promoted, it seems almost satirical. But I don't know the truth of that. And we'll have to see it in the full interview. What it appears is that what might have been done is controversial bits from the middle were edited together to make that seem like the end. And we're just going to have to wait and see. Now, I don't let them fight amongst each other. I don't trust either of them as far as they can throw them. In fact, this is kind of a funny story. This new show that Piers is doing on Talk TV, which is part of News Corporation, it's owned by Rupert Murdoch, who owns Fox and News Corporation. They've been bugging me to appear on that show. But here's the incredible thing. The producers of this new Piers Morgan show, I don't know if I should be saying this. I don't really care. They can hate me. They started contacting me saying, hey, David, we think you would be a great guest for Piers Morgan's new show. Okay, that sounds interesting. Sounds like a publicity opportunity. We would love for you to participate in some rehearsals for the show. Okay, I mean, taking time out of my day to appear on something that's not even going to be broadcast, I don't know. But I guess if it gets me in front of Piers and I get to know him, and that could still be worth it. Yeah, and here's the thing. It's going to be a rehearsal without Piers. It's going to be really like a tech rehearsal for the producers and the engineers and everybody to like get used to running the graphics and the music. So it wouldn't air and it wouldn't be with Piers. It would just be like a stand-in. I'm like, okay, but listen, if you get on our good side, we'll have you on the show, you know, as a guest. When, all right, I guess I'm willing to do it if I just have to, you know, sit in front of Skype in my studio for a few minutes. They go, well, actually, we need you to go to a studio across the city. Guys, I can't do it. I'm sorry. And this is how they dangle in front of you. And I, 8 years ago with other channels, I won't say which ones, I fell for this. Oh, yeah, please take time out of your day to travel to a studio for a rehearsal without even the host. And then we'll have you on all the time. And then they never do. I'm all set, guys. Okay. Everything about the production of this show seems teeter-tottering. So it wouldn't shock me if Piers Morgan deceptively edited this. And if that's the case, then he deserves whatever is coming to him. Now, that being said, it is not uncommon for Trump to walk out of interviews because he doesn't like the questions. It's actually a classic authoritarian move. You claim that just real tough interviews are unfair, and then you bail. And then you use that to justify only speaking to people in unopposed rallies where you just lie, and nobody can oppose what you say. That's a classic Mussolini move. You can read about that in history. And Trump has actually done it before. Remember, he did it with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes.
You're president. And
excuse me, Leslie, you started with me. Your first statement was, are you ready for tough questions?
Are you?
That's no way to talk. There's no way to talk.
Leslie, one second.
At this point, one of our producers interrupted to advise about the time remaining in the interview.
I think we have enough of an interview here, Hope. Okay, that's enough. Let's go. Let's go. Let's go meet for 2 seconds, okay? Thanks. I'll see you in a little while. Thanks.
There's that one. He also did it during a phone interview with NPR's Steve Inskeep when he started getting, they weren't even really like tough questions. They were just substantive questions. Trump didn't like it and hung up the phone. Remember this one?
The only way it's not going to happen again is you have to solve the problem of the presidential rigged election of 2020.
Mr. President, one more question. I want to ask about a court hearing yesterday on January 6th. Judge Amit Mehta, he's gone. Okay.
So the Piers Morgan interview, maybe it was doctored. Maybe it wasn't. We're going to eventually find out. But in all seriousness, Trump's inability to truly be questioned in a serious and detailed manner by journalists and interviewers, it's probably part of why the Republican National Committee has pulled out of presidential debates. My view is let everybody devour each other, doctored or not, whatever. Give Trump the toughest interviews you can. If you doctored the video, you should get devoured by the press. These are all terrible people. I'm talking about Trump here and Piers Morgan. And I think Sunday or maybe it's next week, we'll find out the full scope of what happened in that Trump Piers Morgan interview. If you're listening today and you want to see the clip that we played from that interview, just go to our Instagram at David Pakman Show. We'll have it there. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Ward Farnsworth, who is Dean of the University of Texas Law School and also author of The Socratic Method, a practitioner's handbook. It's so great to have you on today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, David. Good to be here.
So I talk about the Socratic method with my audience frequently, and I think maybe the best place to start would be when we say Socratic, in that word, we're talking about Socrates. So maybe we can start with the origins of why this is a method attributed to Socrates and what it is.
Sure. Well, when people talk about the Socratic method in Socrates, what they usually mean is the style of dialogue and discourse and thinking that you see displayed by Socrates in the dialogues of Plato. We don't really know much about the real Socrates, whether that's how he talked. We know that's how the literary Socrates talked, and that's the model for the Socratic method.
And the model is characterized by questions, but particular types of questions meant to elicit certain type of thinking. Can you talk us through that a little bit?
Yeah, I think the Socratic method is the greatest tool there is for critical thinking and for testing people's views. It has a lot of features and they're hard to summarize quickly, but usually what Socrates is trying to do is work with the beliefs of the person he's talking to. So Socrates doesn't usually say you're wrong. He says, can we agree on this? Can we agree on that? Well, but if we agree on those things, then what about this other thing that you said? It seems like there's a tension there or an issue. So he basically talks people into contradiction with themselves, which is a distinctly effective way of working with people you don't agree with.
One of the things that sometimes is frustrating in the modern landscape is you might get someone to contradict themselves, but they seem unable to recognize that they've contradicted themselves. And so, for example, we see this frequently when I will talk to people who say that Trump is actually the president and it's Joe Biden's fault that gas prices are high. And it's like, well, if Joe Biden's not really the president, how could it be his fault that gas prices are high? That's sort of the contradiction. But sometimes people seem to lack an ability to even understand the contradiction. How would the Socratic method address that?
Well, first of all, if they don't think there's a contradiction, then I'm the one using the method, then my feeling is that's on me. My questions have not been skillful enough, or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there isn't a contradiction. They don't think there is one because it looks like there's one to you. But what they mean when they say Donald Trump's really president isn't what you think they mean. They mean this and you think they mean that. And so there's something additional about their meaning that you've got to get to the bottom of. I just think the right way to think about this is always ask whether, if you're not making headway, it's really on them. Take responsibility and see if you can be more empathetic and try to understand what they mean or what they're thinking. That's an important part of the Socratic method is you're trying to get people to come around to your way of thinking. And before you can do that, you kind of got to come around to their way of thinking or really understand it. And not just like what passes for thoughts, not what passes for thought in the minds of these people you think are idiots, but how they actually look at the world and why it makes sense to them. And once you really get that, it's much easier from that standpoint to then bring them around to something that's more like the way you look at things.
One of the things that seems important in the Socratic method is a sort of humility about our own beliefs. And it seems that the approach of asking questions can be humble in a sense, because you're really trying to learn more about what the other person believes, even if your ultimate goal is that you suspect they're wrong and you want to change their mind. At the same time, there's sometimes the assumption that it's more persuasive to appear more confident in what you believe. So is there a balance that needs to be struck, or is it just not true that it's more persuasive to be confident?
Well, I suppose it's hard to generalize. I'm sure there are people who are very persuaded by confidence and not by humility. But the Socratic method, in any event, is founded on humility. I mean, I know the Socratic method sounds fundamentally like a technique for questioning other people and for trying to bring them around, and it's very powerful for that. But to me, first and foremost, it's a style of thought that if you really care about these things, you try to use yourself. So you're questioning what you think, and you're wondering if maybe you're wrong. And so when you're talking to people, you're trying to help questioning for them to see things your way, but you're also alert to the idea that maybe you have something to learn from them. And I think that one byproduct of that approach is that if you're humble in that way, you're more likely to make headway with others, but you're also more likely to make headway in seeing your own short-sightedness, which is, of course, something we should all want.
Can we talk through in practice how this might sort of appear in, if it's happening at, you know, the Thanksgiving table is often the one people call in. They say, I know my uncle believes that. We could just stick with my uncle believes Trump won. He just believes it was stolen. He believes Joe Biden stole it. And he's going to bring it up and he's going to say, can you guys believe what Joe Biden was able to get away with? And people want sort of a framework with which they can, without upsetting people, without ruining relationships, start a gentle Socratic inquiry. What types of questions might we ask in that situation?
Well, good question. I mean, the first question is, you know, is it worthwhile at the Thanksgiving table to try to chase this down?
Let's assume it is.
We'll assume it is, but I just mean you can be Socratic about the value of using these methods in a given moment. But putting that to one side.
Yeah.
To me, the goal is always, can you find some common ground? Can you find something you agree on that you can then build from? So saying something like, here's what I'm interested in. What would you be willing to count as evidence that the election wasn't stolen, what are you going to count as evidence of anything? I mean, let's just take something that's less controversial and just see if we can agree on that. How do you know that somebody else won the presidential election? Let's talk about an election we can agree on.
Right.
How do you know who won that election? I'm just interested. I mean, I'm really wondering how do you think about that? Because in the sense we don't know, all we know is what we read in the paper. So what makes you so sure that somebody you like that Donald Trump won the first election? And let them explain that for a while. And you say, okay, so that's interesting. So I guess what I'm wondering now is, of those things you mentioned, how many of those things are not also present in the election you are worried about? And so trying to find an election you can agree on before you start talking about an election you can't agree on, I think is a helpful approach. And I would just use that approach in general, is try to find a case you can agree on and then talk through what that case is about and then try to use what you've established in your easy case to sort of gently ask about the hard case.
That's really interesting. It seems there's maybe, in thinking about the empathy component there as well, there might be an opportunity also to find common ground in this conversation to say, are we on the same page that we both want whoever really won to be the president, right? Are we on the same page that's ultimately what we want? We want to know who really won, but that person should definitely be the president. It seems that might also be useful.
Definitely. But then, of course, I think everybody would agree on that. That's a good thing to start with. And then you'd say, OK, now the question is, what does it mean to say somebody really won?
Yeah.
Like, do you mean somebody who got the most popular vote, or do you mean the person who won the Electoral College? Forget about Trump for a minute. Just what do we mean in general? And you keep trying to build agreements on things. And once you have these agreements in place, you narrow everything down. And, you know, I still think that, I mean, in these conversations, of course, you're always hopefully thinking, look, maybe I learned something. And you can say to the person, honestly, let me tell you, if this election was stolen, I want to know. I mean, I don't want to live under a stolen election. I'm sure you don't either, David.
Right.
So if there's any evidence that this was stolen, I certainly would be grateful to hear about it. And I think you can say that. I think anybody can say that and mean it.
What about with one that can be, sometimes when the topic lends itself more to the ideas of experts and who counts as an expert, it can get much more dicey. So, for example, we could think about COVID and vaccines, right? Where there's not only a disagreement about facts, there's a disagreement or misunderstanding about who is a valid authority and about the differences between facts and opinions. Oftentimes, what are opinions are put out there as if it is the type of statement that counts as a fact when really it's only an opinion. And it seems that it's a much tougher hill to climb, seemingly armed only with the Socratic method of questioning. How might would the application be different in such circumstances?
Well, I don't think so, because I think you can still ask questions about other situations where people defer to experts. Like you might say, let's talk about some. Are there any vaccines you do take? Well, why do you take those? Are there situations where expert opinions are enough for you? Because there are for me. And I think actually most of us defer to experts sometimes. And so the question is, when? And can you find a case where the answer is yes? And then what are the features of that case? And then how do the features of that case compare to the features of the case that's in controversy? I think that's a Socratic idea, is you always try to find something that's move over to an easier case where you can agree, and then establish some things you can agree on. Because usually what's going on is, in the controversial case, everybody's judgment is clouded by other features of it, by the politics of it, or the rooting interests that you have, like almost like as a sports fan. And so you're trying to go find a case that is not clouded by those things and establish your principles there and then gently move them over into the case that's giving everybody more trouble.
What about specifically when sometimes the struggle will be when people will call me, I might present what I see as data and reports about a particular issue. And someone will say, well, my experience is just different. So it's an anecdote, right? We're talking about anecdotes versus empiricism. And it's very easy and reflexive to say that's an anecdote and we need to look at broader evidence. But people are often pretty resistant to that. They'll say, no, I mean, listen, this is what I experienced. And so this is real to me in some sense. What sort of advice do you have in that type of situation?
Well, I think first just listen to people. I mean, nobody's going to listen to you unless they feel like you listen to them. So if your immediate reaction is obvious contempt for their experience, then you're just not going to be off to an effective start. But let's imagine that you've done that. And I think at that point, maybe the most helpful way to reason is to ask, well, how do they feel when people make similar claims that are anecdotal or about their own experience, but who they don't agree with? I mean, you know, because that's the kind of claim that people can't stand when it's made by those on the other side. So trying to think of an example, I mean, that's what I think in general is, if you can flip the politics in a situation, like imagine exactly what you're saying, but imagine somebody on the other side making that claim. You can ask somebody, what would you say to them? What would you think of the strength of that claim? I mean, I'm not trying to tell you how you'd feel, but how do you think you'd feel? And of course, it's always perfect if you can think of an actual example and say, well, you know, what you're saying reminds me of somebody I knew that you may have heard about, who actually made a very similar claim, but except that they love everything you hate. And I just wonder, how would you work with that person and say, well, that person's just wrong. Well, I know you think that, but they don't think that. So what would, you know, I guess what you'd probably say to them is their ideas about what counts as evidence don't seem very strong. And then maybe you've got an inroad. I mean, these are not conversations that, you know, you can expect, in which you can expect to turn somebody 180 degrees. The question is, can you make a little headway?
Yeah, it seems that it's, although there is a sort of Socratic toolbox, that it's really more of a framework, is that fair to say, than a sort of how-to?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it is. There is sort of a toolbox. There are a lot of techniques that Socrates uses, but it's also just a mindset and a stance of sort of humility and awareness of your own arrogance and ignorance. You're trying to learn from others in good faith. So I don't think it's a paint-by-numbers scheme for questioning, but if you do study the method in the book, The Socratic Method, that I've written tries to provide some sort of guidance on that. I think it provides you with an approach to hard conversations that can be more productive than just arguing with people directly and contradicting them.
Is there a connection beyond just what seems to be superficially a little bit of overlap between Socrates and Stoicism?
Well, I would say so. The Stoics regard, and when you talk about Stoicism, of course, you're talking about the philosophy. The word Stoicism in modern English has a sort of a meaning of grim endurance of
yes.
suffering or unfeeling. And ancient Stoicism is a much richer, more interesting set of ideas than that. It's really not what it's about. And I think it's a very rewarding body of thought. The Stoics regarded Socrates as their hero, and they thought they were descendants of his. And indeed, I think if you're interested in Stoicism, one feature of the book on the Socratic method is it's sort of meant to be helpful in helping show what the origins of the great Stoic ideas were, because most of them can be traced back to things Socrates said.
If we go back to that era and you know, we think about the trial and execution of Socrates, does that tell us something about just the general distaste many have to have their beliefs questioned?
Well, no doubt it does. I mean, it's important, I think, when you're thinking about the ancient world, not to imagine these were the good old days of unfettered discourse. You know, some people would say Socrates was the first victim of cancel culture. He was canceled pretty good. I just think the way I'd put it is the Socratic mindset is never going to be the majority mindset, because it's too contrary to how human nature works. People fundamentally crave confirmation of what they think by others. So somebody's asking questions that are uncomfortable is never going to be popular. Wasn't popular 2,500 years ago, isn't popular now. But I think it's a very noble and important role. And it's also, I'd say the same thing about any individual. The Socratic function or the Socratic aspect of your own mind is never going to be the predominant one, because it, even in the even in your own psyche, just like in the social world, it's never the strongest force. You know, it's always sort of a minority position. But I think everybody can use a stronger Socratic attitude within their own self, as well as finding use in the Socratic method when they're dealing with others.
The book is The Socratic Method, A Practitioner's Handbook. We've been speaking with the book's author, Ward Farnsworth, who's dean of the University of Texas Law School. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, David. Great to be here. I appreciate yours.
Generally speaking, people who have done nothing wrong don't ask for immunity in order to testify or to talk to investigators. Our old friend Alex Jones is asking for immunity if he is to discuss his role and knowledge related to the January 6th Trump riots. It is not a good week for Alex Jones. Bankruptcy, but a bankruptcy that may be calculated to try to shield assets from people he's ultimately going to have to pay money to, which lawyers say isn't even going to work. And now Alex Jones wants immunity. New York Times report, Alex Jones reaches out to Justice Department about Trump riot interview. The effort by the Trump ally to get an immunity deal is the latest sign of progress in the investigation, which recently brought on a well-regarded prosecutor. The federal investigation into efforts to overturn the election seems to gain traction. Justice Department has brought in a new prosecutor. Alex Jones, the host of the conspiracy-driven media outlet InfoWars, and a key player in the pro-Trump Stop the Steal movement, is in discussions about an agreement to detail his role in the rally. Through his lawyer, Jones said he has given the government a formal letter conveying his desire to speak to prosecutors. The lawyer, Norm Pattis, maintained Jones had not engaged in any criminal wrongdoing that day. As a condition of being interviewed, Jones has requested immunity from prosecution. Now, the reason they're giving is he distrusts the government. So we are to believe Alex Jones believes and knows that he did nothing wrong. But he is so distrustful of the government, he thinks if he talks to them, they will find some crime to pin on him anyway. And that's why he wants immunity. While convincing federal prosecutors to grant him immunity could be an uphill climb for Alex Jones, his discussions with the Justice Department suggest that the investigation could be gathering momentum. 2 weeks ago, another prominent Stop the Steal organizer, Ali Alexander, an associate of Jones, revealed he got a subpoena from a grand jury that is seeking information on a broad swath of people, rally planners, members of Congress, others close to Trump, about what happened on that day. This is absolutely fascinating. Now, again, in general, innocent people don't try to get immunity as a condition of speaking to investigators. Alex Jones wants us to believe it's not because he believes he did something wrong. It's because he believes they are going to sandbag him because he doesn't trust the government. Now, as I spoke to some investigators about this, and they said, listen, anyone can always say they're going to try to find something to pin on me, but that in general, they genuinely, if they don't think Alex Jones is the top dog, right? You want to use people to get the top dogs. That's the general idea here. That why would you talk to Alex Jones first and even consider immunity if you thought he was at the top? No, that's the guy you want to take down. So they believe there's people higher up than Jones. If that's the case, you want to genuinely have a goodwill working relationship with the witness, because that's how they're going to tell you ideally everything or everything you want to know. So only the most paranoid person would think, even in a cooperation agreement, they're going to try to sandbag me. It just doesn't really make sense. It's not typically how these investigations work. Is it possible that they want to charge Alex Jones? Sure, it's possible. But if they're looking to him as a cooperating witness to get bigger names, they're not going to deceptively sandbag him. They might be upfront and say, we're not ready to give you immunity because we actually do think you might have committed crimes. But let's talk. That's the way things can go that way for sure. But the idea that out of nowhere, they're going to sandbag him with the most serious charges, it's just not to the advantage of investigators if they want to get what they think is the most valuable stuff from Alex Jones. Now, the other side of this, is that this all could be a stall tactic. We've also talked about, and we talked about yesterday, that in general, there's lots of people on the periphery of the Justice Department investigation and the January 6th investigation into what is going on, what happened and who was involved with January 6th. And with a midterm election coming up and with an attorney general in Merrick Garland, who is of questionable conviction when it comes to really prosecuting wrongdoing of higher ups when it comes to the January 6th circumstances, running out the clock and stalling as much as possible isn't a crazy idea. So it is not an illogical strategy for Alex Jones to ask for immunity, even if he knows he's not going to get it, simply as a delaying tactic to say, I am willing, but we've got to figure out immunity first. Also remember that if he has relevant information, immunity might do more good than compelling him to testify, because then he'll do what he already did, which is just plead the Fifth Amendment, which he's constitutionally able to do. There's no question about that. Thinking from a practical investigative perspective, you might end up getting more from giving him immunity than from just compelling him to testify, because we know what him and Eric Trump did. They pled the Fifth hundreds of times. So another not great week for Alex Jones. We will see if he gets immunity. Someone sent me a video yesterday that I found fascinating because it reminded me of someone that I've interviewed on the show who has since passed away that I'm going to tell you about in a moment. This is a video I'm going to play for you of a QAnon person who believes that Trump and JFK Jr., a lot of people are confused by which JFK. They believe that this person believes Trump and JFK Jr. are currently the president and the vice president. And one of the delightful things, I love hyper-specific conspiracy theories, as many of you know. This guy also claims that mortgages are invalid, that as soon as you sign a mortgage, the mortgage is paid off. If some of our older listeners might remember who this should remind us of. So let's look at this clip first.
Sure. Did you know all mortgages in the United States are fraud? Every one of them. Everyone is fraud. Did you know your mortgage was paid off? Your mortgage was paid off the moment you signed the mortgage application and they accepted it.
Whoa.
You know who paid it off? You did.
Huh.
See, you're not a debtor, you're a creditor. You just don't know it. You don't know it. They want you to think you're a debtor and that you're indebted to them.
Mm.
Your signature paid off that loan immediately. And you don't know why, do you? Okay, I'm going to teach you guys why.
So I don't know why I find this fascinating. So who does this remind me of? This is a great dip into the archives for some of our younger viewers. There's this guy who passed away in 2019. His name was David Wynn Miller. And I interviewed him years ago. And during the interview, I'm not going to play it for you now, but you can look it up. It's about 10, 20 minutes long. He said things that, like, for example, that he is the king of Hawaii, as one example, that he syntaxed the Magna Carta. But David Wynn Miller's big thing was that you can make yourself a non-taxable entity to the United States with something that he called quantum grammar and the inclusion of extraneous punctuation marks in your name. So like his name was David Wynn Miller, but he would put like a colon before David and then a dash between David and Wynn. And he believed that by becoming quantum grammar, you were no longer taxable, and people tried doing this stuff and they were sometimes held in contempt by courts. So here's a little bit of what David Wynn Miller used to do. This QAnon guy, it seems just like the next version of David Wynn Miller.
When we went to school, they taught us that a sentence must be one thought.
Right.
So we have a one venue or one condition of thought, which is the correct parse syntax grammar.
Parse syntax grammar was a favorite word of his. And if you're looking at this, you also see that he has hyphens between like every word on his whiteboard. That was another thing he did.
However, in the world of fraud, which means you're going to have going to the store from the house. Now we have two different time factors of from and to, which is now a lie because now we have two conditions of time and it's no longer a single thought sentence. So this generates when you're into fraud, fiction, lies, perjury, false, guessing, presumption, assumption.
When my dad was a psychiatrist, when I did the interview with David Wynn Miller years ago, I showed it to him and I said, what do you think about this guy? He's not diagnosing anyone in any formal way. Everybody relax. My dad said, this guy strikes me as what's called a paraphrenic. It's not a schizophrenic. A paraphrenic is someone who has a highly organized set of delusions without hallucinations. This guy's not hallucinating. It's a very organized, sort of like gated set of delusions. And outside of that, they seem like normal people. So sometimes when you have like a paranoid, delusional or schizophrenic, you can't have a normal conversation with them about anything. It's when you speak to them, they're very clearly totally out of touch with reality. You can't talk about the grocery store. You can't talk about sports or whatever. David Wynn Miller, my dad's instinct, not a formal diagnosis, was this is a paraphrenia. With this grammar stuff, it's highly organized and limited. And outside of that, you can seemingly have a normal conversation with the guy. Here's one more video from one of these weird seminars.
The 92nd degree, Mason, is because in 1988, I broke the math interface in all 5,000 languages, proving that language is a linear equation in algebra.
Right.
This hasn't been done in 8,500 years of written language.
He broke the math language interface. Maybe he could fix my toaster.
When I did so, I was able to unlock the 2/3 of all the words missing from all languages in the world, and I can write any sentence in any language frontwards and backwards with the same meaning.
Yep. Even the Maori languages, he's able to write forwards and backwards. So bizarre stuff. And the QAnon guy, it's like the same thing. Let me explain grammatically why you are really the one who is owed the money on the mortgage or whatever the case may be. Wacky stuff, but the point is, all of this stuff recycles. I've told you guys that a lot of the modern revolutionary left, sometimes they're called tankies, but it's sort of a pejorative. The modern revolutionary left are really similar to the 60s era sort of socialist communists that were really common in South America. They were in Argentina, where I was born, and in other countries. It's a rehashing of the same ideas and the same ideology and the same sort of tone and tenor. And even the QAnon stuff isn't really new when they get into these technicalities about grammar and syntax. David Wynn Miller did this stuff for 30 years. May he rest in peace. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Guys, I'm really taking a lot of hits this week. I was criticized for saying that Oprah is to some degree responsible for Dr. Oz because she's the one who brought him to the public. And someone said that that's racist. How dare I accuse a black woman of that? And now I am being criticized because I did not issue a Ramadan greeting on Monday, I guess. Take a listen to this.
Good morning, Wendy from California. With regards to Monday's show greeting, welcoming back from Passover, and then it's like, oh yeah, and Easter. Wasn't it also Ramadan?
I don't know.
I would like to believe that you're not myopic and that you're inclusive and that because of inclusion that leads to objectivity. Last week I was concerned because you thought the Native Americans didn't put up enough resistance. And
now I don't even know what the hell she's talking about there. So the second part, I felt the Native Americans didn't put up enough resistance. I never said that. Okay. That's completely out of this world. But I guess the problem is on Monday, I said, hey, hope everybody had a good Passover or a good Easter. It's good to be back. And I didn't mention Ramadan. So here's the deal. I don't know what the hell is going on as far as religion goes. I know about Passover because I'm culturally Jewish. OK, so that's why I know about Passover. I know about Easter because it's a federal holiday. It's on every calendar. OK, I don't know about anything else going on. So if someone tells me it was Ramadan, it's not because I don't in particular not care about Islam. I just don't know. March 2nd, I looked up. March 2nd was Ash Wednesday. I had no idea. I didn't mention it. I don't know if it's like if the stock market's open and whatever. On Friday, I noticed the stock market was closed. And I was like, why is it closed? I looked it up. Oh, it's Good Friday because it's Easter. That's the only reason I even figured it out. You know, this coming week, this Sunday is Orthodox Easter. I had no idea. I looked it up and I found it. April 29th is Laylat al-Qadr. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. That's a Muslim holiday. I don't know anything. Let's not read in with malice to things that are just really no big deal. Okay, everybody relax. All right, I'm not trying to be disrespectful to anybody. Everybody's welcome to watch this show on any day, regardless of what holidays are going on. On the bonus show today, Netflix has lost viewers for the first time in 10 years. Their stock has absolutely crashed. I lost a bunch of money because I've owned Netflix stock for a really long time. I had forgotten about it. And yesterday, I guess I lost 40%. Okay, we will talk about what's going on with Netflix. Omarosa Manigault Newman has been awarded over $1 million in legal fees from the Trump campaign. Will she ever actually get it? And Senate Democratic candidate Tom McDermott smoked pot in a political ad to celebrate yesterday being 420. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Don't miss it.
RCT, Pittsburgh.
Ain't no time for education. Too much corn in the field. Ain't got time to go to school, y'all. We got too much work around here. Never had time for playing. Never had to have no fun. Too much cotton need hoeing. And that's too much plowing to be done. It was hard, but it was fair. But we was all. Day. Me and my brothers, we was praying for rain, 'cause we still got a hold that hay. It was hard, but it was fair. We was always out there, out in the red hot sun, for all the work we'd never done. Oh, sharecropper's son.
WRCT, Pittsburgh. We'll be right back.
thickening voice, the thing spinning. You have no choice.